between different brain throats in string theory. This is work in progress with Demopoulos, Kachru, Kalapur, and Lawrence. And if time permits, I'll consider a different subject which also involves multiple brain solutions. So I'd like to start by considering a system which at low energies includes degrees of freedom involving two separate Yang-Mills gauge theory sectors, which couple to each other via gravity, and by gravity, I'll mean the full set of degrees of freedom in principle of M-theory. Now, quantum mechanically, as long as there's no selection rule that prevents it, the gauge invariant excitations in these two gauge sectors will mix with each other. And it's interesting to ask the simple question, if, say, in gauge group one, the lightest glue ball mass is greater than that in gauge group two, what is the rate for the glue balls from gauge group one to decay into a set of glue balls in gauge group two? Now, if the Yang-Mills sectors live on brains in M theory, then the ADS-CFT correspondence teaches us a lot about how to make this computation. In particular, when it applies and is useful, it translates this problem that I just posed to a double well tunneling problem, essentially in quantum mechanics. This arises from the translation of a compactification involving separate brain systems, each giving at low energies a different Yang-Mills sector, into the supergravity dual in which, emanating from the Calabi-Yau at various points, there sit brain throats with warp factors decreasing as one goes toward the region describing the infrared physics of the corresponding field theory. So what the ADS-CFT correspondence makes manifest here is that both sets of glue balls are made of the same stuff, gravitons of the 10 or 11 dimensional theory, plus all the excited string modes, et cetera. And the warp factor in this geometry produces a potential barrier between the lightest modes down here in this throat and those in the second throat, since the warp factor produces a redshift as one goes toward the infrared region of each throat. So it would be, of course, very nice to work with a completely explicit compactification geometry plus brains in order to do this calculation. However, in order to be able to be very explicit about the calculations, we will instead work with a toy model of the sort considered by Randall and Sundrum, in which we approximate the brains and the compactification with this simple picture, which was also reviewed this morning in Shama's talk, where one has two separate slices of anti-de Sitter space, which for simplicity will take to each have the same ADS radius scale, big L. The proper distance to the end of one throat I'll denote by big R1, and the proper distance down to the end of the other throat I'll denote by R2. And this leads to glue ball mass spectra exponentially suppressed relative to the ADS mass scale in the way I've indicated here on each side of the system. The compactification geometry is encoded to the extent possible in this kind of toy model by the particular choice of boundary conditions at the ultraviolet end. We're going to take the ultraviolet scale associated with this ultraviolet brain to be the scale 1 over L, which we'll take to be much smaller than the Planck scale in order to get some new physics out. The graviton modes in this background satisfy the equation of motion that I've written here, which takes the form, effectively, of a non-relativistic Schrodinger equation, with the four-dimensional mass squared playing the role of the energy, and the effect of Schrodinger potential arising ultimately from the warp factor appearing in this term here. Now note that in this equation of motion, which of course came from the five-dimensional gravity action, including the Einstein term and the cosmological term in five dimensions, is completely independent of any of the Planck scales in the problem. It's independent of both M5 and of the four-dimensional Planck scale, because in this description, the 5D Planck mass simply scales out of the problem. Now, of course, in real life, where that's defined as M theory, the infrared cutoff arises from some kind of confinement dynamics, and the warp factor is not simply a slice of anti-de Sitter space with this simple warp factor, as was worked out in the work of Palchinsky and Strassler, for example, and many other works on renormalization group flow in generalization of ADS-CFT. And it would be very interesting to calculate the tunneling effect that I'm interested in those exact backgrounds once they're known, once the metrics are really known. This will affect the form of the Schrodinger equation, and in particular the precise form of the potential energy, but it won't change the fact that the equation itself is independent of the Planck scale, and so we expect that the kinds of results we obtain will not depend too much on these details. So in order to work out the answer to the question of the decay rate, let's work in the 5D gravity description, which is the one that's under control in this regime, and consider the following system. Let's take a purely outgoing wave on the right, look for a solution of that equation of motion with a purely outgoing wave on the right, and a mode with both ingoing and outgoing components on the left, in order to ask how likely it is for this outgoing wave on the right to be produced from quanta of the field emanating toward the potential on the left. The equation of motion has solutions which are linear combinations of Bessel functions and Neumann functions, and asymptotically far down toward the ends, infrared ends of either throat, these turn into sines and cosines. One thing that will be important in our interpretation of our results will be the fact that indeed both Bessel and Neumann functions come in. Now recall that in the ADS-CFT correspondence, without an ultraviolet cutoff, the Bessel functions describe normalizable excitations of the conformal field theory, whereas the Neumann functions, which blow up toward the boundary of ADS, describe instead non-fluctuating couplings from the point of view of the quantum field theory, and in the full string theory, they ultimately came from the values of close asymptotic closed string or asymptotic gravity modes in the asymptotic flat region of the brain, full brain spacetime. When there's a cutoff, both of these modes are normalizable, and all of them fluctuate. So given this setup, the transition probability is given by the ratio of fluxes out toward the right over the flux in. And that turns out when we impose standard boundary conditions at the ultraviolet brain to take this form in terms of these linear combinations of Bessel functions. Because of the ultraviolet boundary condition, we express this in terms of the mass, little m, of the mode in four dimensions, which, recall, was exponentially suppressed relative to the ADS scale. And plugging that in allows us to do a simple expansion of the result I just quoted in this quantity, little m times l, which leads, when you do that expansion, to this result I've indicated here, where the probability for transition from one throat to the other goes like ml to the fourth power, or in terms of the geometrical parameters, it goes like e to the minus 4 r over l. Translating that into a decay rate by taking into account the number of collisions per time hitting the barrier, that gives us a result that goes like 1 over l e to the minus 5 r over l. As anticipated, these results exhibit suppression from the barrier, a sort of tunneling suppression, but no suppression factors from inverse powers of the Planck scale. Maybe I'll leave this slide up before I turn to interpretations and possible applications of this result. So I explained that it's independent of the Planck scale. Now let me also consider the issue of how this competes with decays of, say, left throat modes into light modes that might live in the compactification. A similar five-dimensional analysis that I won't go over here gives essentially a degeneracy factor suppressing that rate relative to the rate that I just calculated for you. So now I want to turn to how we understand this result from the point of view of the four-dimensional gauge theories, which I started the discussion with. So again, in the full ADS-CFT correspondence, the two types of modes that arise here correspond, in the case of the normalizable Bessel functions, J, to excitations in the low-energy field theory, whereas the non-normalizable modes, including admixtures of the Neumann functions N, correspond to couplings in the gauge theory or asymptotic closed-string modes in the full-brain geometry. Now, in the cutoff theory, or the compactified theory, all of the above modes become dynamical. So I want to look a little bit more closely at the result we just obtained and compare it to what we might expect from low-energy effective quantum field theory. Now, if we simply had two conformal field theories coupled to each other via four-dimensional gravity, and we were talking about these graviton excitations, which are supposed to correspond to excitations created by the stress-energy tensor of the field theory, then the interaction Hamiltonian, the lowest such interaction that we could write down, would involve a product of stress tensor on one side times the stress tensor on the other side, which being dimension 8 would be made up, its dimensions would be made up with four inverse powers of the four-dimensional Planck scale. The resulting transition probability would then go like squaring the amplitude arising from this would then go like 8 inverse powers of M4, and the rate would go like little m to the ninth over M4 to the eighth, a much smaller effect than what we're seeing. Our result is different in two ways. One is that the ultraviolet scale that comes in the denominator is not the four-dimensional Planck scale. Instead, it's this UV scale 1 over L. And also, the contribution that we're getting over there is consistent with the low-energy effect of Hamiltonian coupling the two sectors via a dimension 6 operator rather than a dimension 8 operator. You can see that by looking at the powers of our cutoff scale L that appear over there, namely the probability going like L to the fourth means that the amplitude went like L squared, which makes up the dimensions for a dimension 6 contribution to the low energy effect of Hamiltonian. So this is a slightly puzzling situation, and one possible interpretation is, which we're considering, is the following. Our eigenmodes, again, as I keep emphasizing, involved both the normalizable Bessel functions from the full ADS and the ones, the Neumann functions N, which would not have been normalizable in the full ADS space. And if we extrapolate the ADS-CFT duality to our cutoff system, as has been suggested by many, many people, then we might continue to make the same dictionary, namely that the Bessel function excitations should correspond to excitations of the original stress-energy tensor, whereas the things which used to not be normalizable in the full ADS should have to do with the newly normalizable closed-string excitations which exist in the compactified theory. In that kind of interpretation, the low-energy quantum field theory that we get in this full compactified system doesn't simply, we shouldn't expect it to simply have the stress-energy tensor of the original field theory. Instead, that can get contributions from the newly fluctuating closed-string sector. And our calculation suggests a particular way in which that happens, at least the dimension of an operator, depending on these asymptotic closed-string modes, which should appear in order to reproduce the dimension 6 coupling, would be an operator, like I've written here, of dimension 2, depending on the five-dimensional gravity modes and perhaps extrinsic curvature couplings at the UV brain. Now, having considered the interpretation of this result and its independence of the Planck scale leading order, let me just mention a rather speculative potential application of this effect that we've had fun thinking about. So one application of any multiple brain situation is to hidden sector physics, and probably the most solid application was the one about supersymmetry breaking discussed earlier this morning. But another thing to think about with respect to hidden sectors is the spectrum of dark matter and its properties. In our sort of setup, either in this picture or in the Calabi-Yau picture with multiple brain throats, one predicts that the dark matter coming from these hidden sectors will change in time according to this tunneling decay rate that we've calculated. So in particular, cold dark matter will decay into hotter dark matter at some rate determined by the parameters of the compactification. Now, as is well known, cold dark matter with a cosmological constant works well in interpreting all known observations, in particular the serious constraints of nucleosynthesis, and so on. However, there has arisen an interesting issue, a possible discrepancy of sort of very weakly interacting cold dark matter, which had been the standard spectrum, with observations, more detailed observations of the shape and concentration of dark matter in galactic halos. According to some analyses, the real halos are more diffuse, less spiky in the center than the ones which emerge from simulations of cold dark matter theories. So there are some interesting and promising solutions to this problem. One of them involves simply making the cold dark matter interact and putting constraints on that. Another one involves a sort of fluid picture of dark matter. And some people think that after all the relevant recounts, there's actually no problem after all. So we certainly aren't claiming that this is definitely a problem, but it is an interesting situation to keep track of and an interesting opportunity to constrain further properties of dark matter. Now, in our situation, we might speculate that one could have a situation where one of the throats involves sort of standard cold dark matter, which is decaying very recently or currently, in particular long after it's done its job in facilitating nucleosynthesis. And this tunneling effect would then reduce the clumping and central concentration of the halos in current epoch as it decays to hotter stuff that expands. Now, there's an interesting piece of numerology whose significance is not very clear, but I'll mention it anyway. If you take this seriously and set the lifetime of these particles to be of the order of the age of the universe, that's 10 to the 16 Planck units, you get scales in this geometry, which are like the ADS radius scale and the five-dimensional Planck scale, which are roughly gut scale. So why gut scale physics scale is coming out here is kind of an interesting question. Okay. I guess I have time to discuss this, the second topic involving multiple brain throats, but let me just flash the conclusions to the main part of the talk over there. So now I'd like to discuss some ingredients in an approach to a rather lowbrow approach to de Sitter model building, which again ends up using multiple large N brain sectors. So in order to obtain de Sitter space as a solution of string theory or M theory at low energies, we need to answer a simple question. We need a local minimum of the scalar potential, depending on moduli L and maybe the dilaton, if you want to distinguish that, in a metric frame with no moduli dependence in front of the Einstein term in the D space-time dimensions. In this frame, one finds that the terms that contribute to the scalar potential tend to go to zero as radii get big or as a dilaton gets small, depending on what kind of limit you're in. So one of the ways in which, at least I found this kind of simple question a little more difficult than I might have anticipated, is the following. So we're looking in a perturbative description for a minimum of a scalar potential, an extremum, which is above zero, and which is in fact a minimum, coming, say, in the simplest approach, from balancing different terms in a perturbation expansion in, say, 1 over L, where L is the radial modulus. Now, since we have large quantum numbers that can be introduced into these coefficients that I've labeled Cn in this perturbative expansion, similarly to the way that Banks and Zaks found fixed points at large n in gauge theory, one can hope to balance different terms off, different terms in this perturbation expansion off each other by introducing large numbers into the coefficients of formally subleading terms in the expansion. And the issue just has to do with getting the signs to work out. So in particular, if we want to be modest and simply look for at least a metal stable minimum of this potential with the right properties, we need a leading term in this perturbation expansion which is positive, a subleading term which is negative, and a term which also competes with these two, which is positive, to drive it, to make it stable. In particular, that requires this negative piece whose coefficient needs to be at least discretely tunably bigger than the positive coefficient in front of the leading term. Now, there are lots of ways to get contributions to the effective potential which are order one or more positive, such as adding brains with positive tension, curvature, fluxes, and so on. And it's also easy enough to get order one negative contributions coming from finite numbers of orientifolds and, say, in two-dimensional compactifications, positive curvature, and so on. But we need this large negative contribution in the second term. So this can come from a situation, again, with multiple brain throats. Here, what I've drawn is a compactification involving both brains and anti-brains, which are fixed in place by an orbifold projection, which shifts in position along the compactification and maps brains to anti-brains. These ingredients lead to a positive contribution coming from the brain tensions, which is proportional to their charge, to the number of such brains, and also a negative contribution coming from the attraction that the brains and anti-brains have with each other, which, since their relative position within the compactification has been frozen, simply acts on the modulus L of the compactification. Then the needed positive contributions that turn it back over again can come from independently tunable flux contributions. So these ingredients suggest that there should be a discrete set of at least metastable de Sitter models, and I will spare you the details of some candidate models that I have in progress, but just wanted to share this basic idea with you. And with this and those conclusions, I will stop and ask for questions.
Any questions?
Could you remind me how cold dark matter in fact interacts with nucleosynthesis? Is it that you don't want cold dark matter or the dark matter to spoil nucleosynthesis, or is there some sense in which it actively facilitates it?
Oh, it's just the way it affects the geometry is right for nuclear synthesis at that epoch, So you can't screw around with that too much back then, but that, which is why we put the tunneling effect at a much later time.
Eva, did you want the cold dark matter particles to decay to hot dark matter particles, which would be in halos today?
They would be decaying today into these, into the halos.
You want them to decay into hot particles that would be in today's halos?
Okay, the roughly yes, although they don't have to be arbitrarily hot. There can be this infrared cutoff on the second throat. And one interesting scale to put there is the scale of the halo itself. And the new blue balls would be confined at that scale. But there's a whole window. This is not very constraining data, needless to say. And there's a huge window of possibilities.
The hot particles are hot because they're lighter?
Because they're lighter, right.
So when a heavy one, which is in a halo, decays today to a light one, the light one simply escapes. It doesn't end up in a halo.
There are interactions between them, and depending on the scales, they can behave like a fluid. And there's also this, depending on the initial conditions, there's also this effect that part of what's going on is that in this ADS-CFT picture, the things will stretch out in the radial direction in the four-dimensional picture. So that kinetic energy will eventually be cut off by the confinement scale. And but there's really a whole window of possibilities which we're only beginning to explore.
Coming back to the first part of your talk, didn't you get a sense of how much dependence this convention about dimension six operators had on the boundary conditions you put at the ultraviolet ray? I would imagine you could change that operator if you played around it.
I think you're correct about that. In fact, one might think the most generic contribution would be even stronger. In other words, would not go like m to the fifth, but would go just like m. And from this point of view, that would essentially not be a tunneling effect at all. It would be put into the tree-level Lagrangian, essentially. So we took the next most generic situation, which gives this result. But indeed, there are special choices of boundary conditions for which you could suppress also this contribution. That's exactly correct.
There are no questions. Let's thank the speaker again.